Okay, thank you everyone for coming back after lunch. So today we've got Saffron Sweeney, who's going to be talking to us about the effects on superannuation and of broken service and part-time work, and then some possible solutions. So Saffron has over 25 years of experience at Aon in employee benefits consulting, which encompasses defined contribution, defined benefit and long service leave benefits, providing advice on benefit designs, funding, accounting and liability management for organisations, mergers and acquisitions advice, as well as strategies and assistance in communicating to employees and members. She's the mother of four children, and I heard her talking about earlier, and currently works part-time 3 days a week and has worked part-time for the last 13 years. Therefore, this is a topic that's really, you know, I guess, core to her and one that she's been thinking about for quite a while, and feels that with the Senate inquiry into women's super balances now being a great time to actually come up with possible solutions and actually try to resolve this issue once and for all. She's also currently a member of the Legislation Subcommittee of the Superannuation Practice Committee, and so I'm sure she can make all of this come to light. Please welcome Saffron.
Thanks, Diane. So good afternoon. And I will start by saying, as Diane mentioned, that this is a topic very close to my heart. And as a mother of four, I have actually met a lot of people who have taken time out of the workforce, currently work part-time, and can be quite considerably long periods in these things, to raise families. Most of them have been women, although I have met the odd male who has chosen to take time out of the workforce or reduce their working hours for family commitments or other reasons, which could include illness or caring for parents or other issues. I have a friend who is a nurse, and her husband is a nurse, and they actually have both shared parental responsibilities by both working part-time. So there's lots of juggling that occurs in those situations, and I'll show you today that that actually affects their superannuation balances as well. I do want to mention up front that broken service and part-time work is not specifically a gender issue. However, it has affected more women in the past. And as I speak, if I refer to women, I'm not suggesting that it should exclude males and that the situation would not be the same if they had taken those same paths. And it's just that there's obviously been a higher proportion of women, and so the statistics and information has affected, you can see it in the effect on women's superannuation balances. I do also want to note that the presentation is looking at superannuation for the individual. I've not considered the effect for couples, and I haven't incorporated anything regarding other assets, home equity or debt. So it's just looking at superannuation balances. There we go. I'll first set the scene by showing that there are a number of people who are not working full-time for various reasons, that flexible working arrangements will become more popular in the future, and that flexibility is great, but it does affect your super balance, that there have been a large number of people's superannuation balances impacted by the current system, and that if it continues, the issue of inadequate retirement incomes will not be solved for people in these circumstances. So I provide some possible solutions. Finally, we will look at how actuaries can get involved. The superannuation system was designed to reflect traditional patterns of work, continuous full-time employment. It is hard to imagine now, but in Claire Bellis's book, The Future Managers, Actuaries in Australia, 1853 to 1997, maybe some of you read it, she noted that female actuaries were made to resign on marrying well into the 1970s, and part-time work didn't become available for female actuaries until the late 1970s. And if women did choose to work part-time, they had to accept that their careers would be set back. Times have changed, And companies are now providing employees more options with regards to flexible working arrangements. Although predominantly women have been asked for and taken this option, for raising family or caring for elderly people, there are now more employees asking for this option to provide for a better work-life balance. Work patterns can also be broken due to illness or the inability to find work. So continuous full-time employment, spanning 40 years or so, will become less of the norm in the future. As superannuation contributions are generally linked to your income, having large periods out of the workforce or working part-time will significantly reduce your final superannuation benefit. So first of all, we'll look at carers, and there are 2.7 million Australians who care for others. Our country relies on these carers and will depend on them more as Australia ages. The Gender Indicators report, released in February 2016 by the Australian Bureau of Statistics, had 2006 data, so I'm sorry it's a bit outdated, but it was only released this year. And it showed that women particularly were spending more hours in per day caring for dependent children than they were in 1997, which may shock you because you'll see later that there's actually been an increase in women who've gone into the workforce. How does that work? Less sleep. You can also see from the graph that there are significantly more hours per day spent by women than men in these duties, which I suppose is not surprising. Even with a full day of work, so people working on a full-time basis, there are still a lot of hours performed in unpaid work, performed caring for dependent children. And interestingly, I think this matches my experiences. I think that there has been a change in parenting styles over the generations, where we are actually more involved in children's activities, a lot more volunteer, sporting, in the classroom requirements than our parents did. And that actually means quite a lot of time in the unpaid side, as well as then trying to juggle potential working time. But there are many, obviously, particularly females who are not in the workforce at all, caring for dependent children. So with so many hours involved in caring for dependent children, it isn't surprising that many people are wanting flexibility in their working patterns. Other kinds of dependent care or carers are those with a disability. And this graph shows that there are a significant proportion of men and women who are the primary caregiver for a person with a disability. And this also reduces their capacity to work. And again, significantly more females are involved in this than males. And these carers have less paid work and many don't work at all. They often find themselves in part-time or casual jobs and leave the workforce earlier. Some carers have multiple jobs and may receive no contributions to their superannuation if the earnings from each individual employer is less than $450 a month, even though the combined salary may actually exceed that on a monthly basis from various employers. There are a growing number of companies offering flexible working arrangements. The number of staff going part-time to pursue commercial and academic interests has surged in the last 5 years. Based on ABS statistics, the proportion of the workforce that works part-time has increased from 20% in 1991 to 31% today. And I've actually got 35 years of data there. And you can see with the blue line, this is men in 1980, and 2015 is the green line. So the number of males working full-time has actually reduced, basically at every age apart from 60 to 64, where potentially more of them are working when they may have retired in the past. And women, They're the red line in 1980 and the purple line bars in 2015. And apart from the younger ages, all of the others show a significant increase in females who are working now full-time. And I believe, and I haven't actually gone and it's hard to sometimes confirm this with the ABS data, but I think that there has been a significant increase in women, going into the end of high school and then into at university and college education. Hence, why the 15 to 19 and maybe not 20 to 24 group has actually reduced for women, because they've actually gone into more studies than going straight to full-time work in their, late teens. The other thing to consider is that there are people who would like full-time work but are unable to obtain that work, either due to illness or just unable to find suitable employment. It is like putting salt on a wound, because not working in the present will have a significant financial impact in the future. So whether or not working full-time was by choice or necessity, the fact is that people's superannuation balances will be lower by working less in full-time paid work. For many women, it is in their relatively young years, and the effects of not achieving that compound interest on the superannuation means that the gap in superannuation they have will not necessarily meet their requirement for retirement, and it's almost unbridgeable because it's compounded that you've lost in not putting that superannuation contribution in. Although superannuation balances for men and women are affected by broken work and part-time work, it obviously has been more women, and I'll show you in a graph shortly, that the average superannuation balance for women is significantly lower than men at some ages. And you can see here that at the early ages, they're fairly close. So the ATO actually released these superannuation statistics this year relating to the 2013-2014 financial year. And the graph shows the average superannuation balance by gender and age. The balances are close, as I said, at the earlier ages, but as we go up the graph, the red bar is lower than the blue bar, which is female versus male. And I believe that part of the issue was due to broken working patterns and part-time work. I will note that at the more mature ages, one of the reasons for the gap in male and female super balances is that the compulsory superannuation system didn't exist for them in their early careers, and women were less likely to be offered access to superannuation than males. I also acknowledge the elephant in the room, which is that one of the main reasons for the gap in average super balance are lower average wages, but that's a whole another topic, so I won't go into that. So if we can see that we're getting substantial differences, then obviously that impacts what they've got available in their retirement years. And there was a Senate inquiry noted as, "A husband is not a retirement plan." Achieving Economic Security for Women in Retirement report. This was released on the 29th of April this year, and there were 19 recommendations which were made to help women increase their participation in the workforce and improve their superannuation savings as a means of achieving dignity in retirement. It may take some time for these proposals to be agreed, if at all, and implemented. So employees and employers may also need to take some action to reduce the chance of losing out on compound interest while waiting for these changes. I've done some very basic projections. They're very simplistic, but it's just to look at the differences in the effect of taking part-time or having broken working patterns. So I've used, just as a general, 22-year-old, July 2015, with no current superannuation balance. I'm assuming a salary of $40,000 to start, and just receiving SG contributions from their employer, which are currently 9.5%, but will rise on the current legislated amount to 12% at 1 July 2025. Salary is assumed to increase at 2.5% per annum, and investment earnings, net of all fees, tax, etc., of 7% per annum, which may seem slightly aggressive looking at the current market, but I'm looking at a 43-year projection. I have compared them with the ASFA Comfortable Lifestyle and Retirement, which at the moment is for a single is $545,000 at retirement age of 65. I've increased it by AWE for 43 years at 2.5% per annum. I do note that this assumes that someone owns their own home at retirement, because the cost of living is often higher if you're renting. So having a look at that, we have a number of scenarios. The green line across the top is that ASFA Comfortable Lifestyle and Retirement, just inflated to age 65 for this person. And we've got a number of scenarios. The first one, the very bold blue, light blue, is a person who works continuously in their working life. The second one is a person who works continuously full-time apart from 2 years of leave without pay at age 28 and age 30. The next one is someone who comes back to work on a part-time basis until their age 50. So they'll work 3 days a week, but they'll have the year off at 28, the year off at 30, but they'll work part-time until they're 50 after 28. And then the next person just never returns to full-time work. They stay part-time for the balance of their career after they've taken some time out of the workforce. I've put in the dark blue line because it's been quite common out of the people I've known that there's been some people retrenched in their early 40s. And at that level, they're often more senior and find it harder to find an appropriate job. So I thought I'd have a look at what that does. Just 2 years out of the workforce. Another alternative that we're seeing with people potentially working longer than previous generations, well into their 60s, maybe even 70s, there's probably going to be a higher proportion of people who might would like to gradually retire, so maybe work 3 days a week from age 60. So that one there. The orange one is someone taking 10 years out of the workforce, which is not completely uncommon for someone who wants to just raise their young family till maybe all of their children go to school and then return to the workforce full time. And the next one is if they return to the workforce after the 10 years off, just working 3 days a week rather than full time. And the last one's just a comparison with the second last one, assuming a starting salary of $70,000, just to show you that obviously salary does matter, but the part-time and broken working pattern will affect that person. Just they're obviously going to have a better chance of meeting a comfortable lifestyle than someone who's on a lower salary. So very simplistic, but it can show you how the effect it does really affect you. Obviously, the later in life that you take the time out of the workforce or go part-time, it's got less of an impact on your final balance than the earlier periods out of the workforce or working part-time for significant periods or taking significant amounts out of the workforce. I think I said all that one. This one, I just thought, just to show you the difference of if a voluntary contribution of 3% per annum was made. The reason that I have selected 3% is that in the past, many people have proposed that a 15% contribution would be more likely to provide an adequate level of retirement income. And also, 3% is seen to be affordable and large enough to make a difference. So it's that balancing act of not requiring too much but not too little, otherwise there's no point. And you can see based on an extra 3% per annum that more people are going to have an opportunity to meet that comfortable lifestyle amount. You can see there the super amount with and without. So the orange is the without and the aqua blue is with. So even small amounts out of the workforce, 2 years out or working part-time from age 60, certainly that person would meet that comfortable lifestyle requirement. I actually think that one of the issues with regards to broken work and part-time work is a lack of awareness. Now, I understand that they realise they're not earning an income, but sometimes they then don't think through that what that means is I'm also not having any superannuation savings made for me in those years. And so part of it's a lack of awareness. I think a lot of the time it's because you're not considering superannuation. If you're in your 20s and 30s particularly, there's not a lot of evidence of people getting very concerned about their super. So taking these items, working part-time, broken work, super is just not really considered at all. I'm not suggesting that it would necessarily make a difference. They may just be more informed so that they can either go and get some advice or some help to consider if they've got options to improve that situation, or at least they may have lower their expectations on their expected retirement income. So it's just more awareness and make informed decisions that I mean there. So we actually heard at a recent session, the SEBPC session, that the David Murray FSI inquiry recommended that the purposes of superannuation be determined, and the government in recent budget proposed they had agreed an objective to superannuation to provide an income in retirement to substitute or supplement the age pension. And I think that a lot of people would probably aim for something better than this. If the goal of superannuation is, say, to provide that comfortable lifestyle in retirement, then continuing with the status quo will not be adequate for those with broken service or part-time work. And I will note that there are many who don't do very much paid work at all in their lifetimes, and if those, for whatever reason that has occurred, and those people will rarely accumulate very much superannuation at all, based on the way the current system is run. There are also self-employed people who are not required to have contributions paid to superannuation funds for them. Many people see that their business is their retirement plan. However, that obviously means that their business needs to succeed, so their whole livelihood, including their future retirement, is based on that business achieving its goals. And the Senate inquiry report actually made a recommendation that encourages all self-employed people, and in particular the self-employed women, because it was specifically focusing on women, to consider the need to make superannuation contributions to ensure they will have enough money to live on when they retire. And it is likely that to meet some of these goals, there'll need to be a suite of measures. The Senate inquiry reviewed many submissions and agreed that there needs to be a multifaceted approach, incorporating both long and short-term measures. For example, contribution cap changes would assist some women in maybe catching up when they've actually got available, take-home pay after they return possibly to full-time work, or they've paid off more of their mortgage, or their kids have left home. But there's many who will never, ever have that capacity. So this next graph shows the average account balances by gender and tax bracket, and it does show that females earning over $37,000, actually their balances compare relatively well to males. But those on the lower income tax brackets, there's fairly substantial differences. But if you have a look at it, the average balances of people, particularly those earning under $180,000, with an average balance of $84,000, we've got a long way to go to ensuring all people will be able to have dignified retirement. And I note that the Senate inquiry also mentioned that single women are one of the fastest growing people living in poverty, and single women are at the greatest risk of experiencing poverty in retirement. So it's an important issue because we've actually got a lot of people living in poverty in retirement. And it's reported that one in three women are currently living alone between the ages of 55 and 70. So their title of their report, Husband is Not a Retirement Plan, is quite valid. There's significant numbers of people who might not have a husband to have their super or assets fall back on. So there are a number of possible solutions which could be taken or to help meet these superannuation goals. These, of course, would need to be modelled and take into account fiscal responsibilities and constraints, but are listed here to raise awareness and of some technical possible, you know, technically possible options, and might actually potentially spark some new ideas. We could raise the super guarantee rate to 12% a little quicker. Currently, not till 2025, but the Senate inquiry has also recommended, why don't we move it there a little earlier? We could introduce SG on paid parental leave. That has been also recommended by the Senate inquiry. We could continue SG on things like leave without pay. And I note that actually there's been a couple of companies in our industry who have started to pay super guarantee contributions on paid and unpaid parental leave, the likes of Westpac, Rice Warner, Equip Super, ANZ, to name a few. Compulsory superannuation contributions could be paid on salary continuance or even for workers' compensation. There's been discussion on whether SG could be paid into a superannuation fund for those on welfare payments. And you may ask, well, why? The government will be potentially likely to pay their age pension. But there is obviously this intergenerational issue. We're using tax dollars now to pay for retirees who worked in the past, and that will continue, and there might be this mismatching, particularly with an ageing population. So potentially building up retirement balances to reduce the impact on age pension in the future, which is tax dollars in the future for the now workers. Could pay contribution. I mean, this one's a big one, but could pay contributions on equivalent full-time salary, maybe up to the maximum SG base for those who work part-time, rather than pay it the based on their actual paid salary. Some other options are compensating people for caring responsibilities, so potentially, again, paying super contributions for those who are carers, continuing the low-income super contribution, and I note that this was recommended by the Senate inquiry, also the Institute of Actuaries, and the government in its budget proposed a little change and call it the low-income superannuation tax offset. You could have lifetime caps on contributions, and again, the budget has proposed a five-year rolling cap for those with balances under $500,000, so that could be helpful for some catch-up contributions. You could have joint superannuation with joint limits. You could have just a joint contribution limit for the contributions. We could increase the breadth of the spouse contribution so that others could contribute to your super and get a tax deduction if you're on a low income. So at the moment it's for spouses only who could do that, but not everyone has a spouse. So potentially maybe you could get parents or children or someone else contribute to your super for you if you're a low income earner and they would achieve a tax rebate. At the moment, the government has proposed a change to the criteria from a low income of only $10,800 to being a low income of $37,000 for that. So, but that's the spouse version of that current option. You could have no minimum earnings for super contributions, so that people who work in lower paid and casual work would still get their superannuation paid into a fund for them. The main reason I believe that they set a limit was to limit the, you know, administrative issues with dealing with small amounts paying paid to super, but now with technology and Superstream and various things like that, maybe it would be more viable to allow super cons to be paid for all. And again, that was a proposal in the Senate inquiry. We could reinvigorate the government co-contribution, making it a little bit more worthwhile for those with low incomes, because they actually have to sacrifice up to $1,000 of their after-tax pay. It used to be a return, quite a large return. You'd get $1,500 back if you contributed $1,000 if you were under the minimum earnings limit. But it's gradually reduced to $500, so it's less incentivizing for people on low incomes to make those contributions at the moment. We could introduce a compulsory member contribution. As I said, it does make a difference with achieving your goals, but I realise that does have an impact on their take-home pay. There's been evidence that women take less risk in regards to their investments than men. Obviously we're going to live a long time, and our superannuation doesn't just last till six, you know, need to be invested till 65, and listen to all the talks on retirement incomes, and we're going to live well into our probably 90s. So maybe encouraging people to consider their investment style a bit more aggressively. So those are just a couple of options, or a number of options. Some of you may have some different ideas, and I'd love to hear them. I wondered if there's anything that actuaries can do to improve financial literacy so that people in these circumstances at least are aware. Like, I'm not sure if all of them realise that they could make, contributions to their super and get the government co-contribution. Maybe we could do more there. I'm not sure what else actuaries can do, but obviously our employers and many of us who are involved in superannuation funds could possibly get more involved in that. Are there other options that could be available to help people meet their goals? And I'm particularly looking at low income, people with broken service and part-time work and lower incomes. They're the ones that at the moment may only receive the age pension or not much more, and it really is living in poverty. And thirdly, should we be talking to government about options which make the most sense, obviously considering their constraints? So thank you.
Thanks, Sophron. Who's going to be the first one who wants to ask a question or make a comment? Remember to introduce yourself.
My name's Jonathan Sheep, dead battery.
that battery's dead. Jonathan Sheed, father of four and one stepson. Thanks for that presentation. Two things perhaps you could comment on. You made a comment about people living in poverty on low incomes and providing for them. I know that there has been discussion and work around a total financial well-being, and that if you have a choice between providing either government or corporate funding towards superannuation, is that the best use of resources for someone who is on a low income or living in poverty right now? So how do you make that trade-off? That was the first question. The second question is just around household income, and you had a couple of great suggestions there about joint limits and joint contributions. My sense is that where one partner takes time off, often the household income is fine. It's just that one partner has a much lower level of income and hence lower money going into super. Ideally, you don't want that to become a family court issue if the marriage or the partnership dissolves. Otherwise, it really doesn't matter where the superannuation kind of comes up. So I wonder if you had any further thoughts about looking at household income, maybe even a forced superannuation within a household where contributions automatically get divided between two accounts.
Well, total financial well-being and the trade-offs. I haven't actually looked at in terms of government, employers, and whether there's other avenues. But I suppose one of my issues is that we're assuming the current system and the age pension and everything will continue. Maybe it won't. The age keeps rising. Not everyone will be able to keep working up to those ages, up to 70. Especially, you know, we heard the CBUS guy saying that's just not going to work. And if they already have low balances and they end up on some sort of welfare, that's actually poverty as well. So I'm of the view that we need to consider assisting people to get something better than the age pension. And I feel that putting it into a retirement product, at least we're saving for it now and not waiting to see what taxpayers might have to do in the future to make that happen. It's just an idea. The household income, it'd be interesting to see if there's the ability to force contributions to be split or something over a family. There will always be some that say, well, that will be wrought, the system will be wrought if you do that, with the high income earners trying to put more money into their lower earning spouse's super. And I suppose often, I mean, I know we're all much higher income earners than average, but a lot of these people on low incomes, they might not be able to even afford putting something into their spouse's contribution. I mean, I didn't even touch the subject of marriage breakdown. And, of course, we know that you can have contribution, super splitting on family, you know, family breakdown. But sometimes that it's not an equal 50-50. If one party gets the house, one party might not have as much super, that party might not have as much super than the other. So there's currently no requirement to ensure that the super is fairly split. It's just that super is now included in the assets of the partnership in terms of the marriage breakdown. So, I'm just throwing out some ideas because I think maybe they haven't been thought through. And as I said, I think the flexible arrangements are becoming more common, so maybe we need to consider some options that will suit that new regime. I mean, I read a lot of articles about people who are just even millennials, like Gen Y people who one girl likes to do DJ work. So what she was doing is she was working Friday night, Saturday night and Sunday night as a DJ and was struggling to go to work on Monday morning in her usual 5-day-a-week job. She arranged with her employer to have Mondays off. So she works a 4-day-a-week plus DJs 3 nights a week. And this seems to be more common. Millennials are expecting these things. They don't see it as a desirable perk. They see it as a necessity that you provide them flexibility. So I hope that helped.
We have a microphone that works now, so feel free.
Paul Shalhoub. Thanks very much, Saffron. That was great. One of the things quite a few super funds are doing is having retirement projections and income projections on statements, and maybe is starting to go in the direction that you were looking for in terms of helping people understand how much they might have at retirement. Not quite sure how we handle people who are out of the workforce with those sort of projections. Did you have any thoughts on that?
Yeah, that's a good point. And again, those projections, and I think someone mentioned in one of the other sessions, like at the moment they generally show your current, you know, salary projecting forward. They don't show, well, what if your salary halved overnight because you went part-time? What happens if your salary doubled overnight because you're currently part-time and you go back to full-time work? So, but a lot of calculators might allow that, and, you know, you can move the bars. Those who currently are not in superannuation, again, I think it's a lot of a lack of awareness, and maybe this is where financial literacy needs to be improved. I know the government extended financial literacy information in maths courses in primary schools. So in years 3, 5, you know, they have specific ideas regarding financial literacy, and they obviously change with age, so that concepts of financial information are starting to be learned and taught in the primary school area. But we've obviously got a big part of the population who have passed primary school. So I don't know whether there's campaigns that can be done and you know, free projection websites where people can just go and at least tinker. I think, though, a lot of the population just, this is so hard for them to understand. And it's just, how can we get alongside them? And you know, a lot of them can't afford to see a financial advisor. It's just, yeah, I'd love some ideas on how we can help those people so that they can, you know, do the best they can with what they've got as well.
Thanks, Saffron. I'm Kevin O'Sullivan. I'll just give you some stuff about what we do at UniSuper. We, if you're a part-timer and you get projected benefits, you're assumed to stay your current part-time. But we have tools that allow you to play with future projections. Financial literacy, we do a lot of work, particularly around Women's Day or Women's Week or whatever it's called. We make sure that people do get to understand Super, they're Super. We were talking in a group in the last few months about inheritances. And inheritances and lifetime caps is a big issue. So people might actually not have lots in Super, but then they get to close to retirement and then they get an inheritance. And there's a feeling that, particularly with government changes, that's going to actually cause grief for some people who have worked part-time breaks in service.
Yeah, of course, the inheritance issue is, it's hard to know, again, whether that will make a difference to people in the future, because we're now looking at potentially having to use some of our housing wealth to live off in retirement. The Senate inquiry report was quite extensive. It's about 150 pages long. I have read it. And unfortunately, a lot of the people that they were looking at, many of them rent, and it's generations. It's often, you know, if you don't have a property to leave and someone inherits, then that often it's a cycle. So the very low income people don't have houses and are not likely to possibly even get an inheritance as well. So yeah, the very low end, we've never going to have that covered. But certainly middle Australia, middle incomes, where currently they're probably going to end up on a part age pension, depending on an inheritance, might mean that they might not be on a part age pension. They may actually end up being self-funded. It's very variable. But certainly now you can't contribute, if the current proposal goes through, you can't contribute your inheritance necessarily to the super fund, because you might exceed the $500,000 non-concessional limit, but you have it as an outside asset. Yeah.
Sorry, if I can, Jonathan Sheed again. The comment about increasing financial literacy always is a bit of a red flag to me. The way I express it is, I'm sure right at this moment there is a conference of motor mechanics trying to work out how we can get people to understand the workings of a car better. There's a dentist convention somewhere that are talking about what we need to do to increase people's knowledge about how to deal with their teeth. I think it's very easy for us as an introspective industry to say everyone else needs to get up to speed. To me, I think the onus is on us to work out more effective ways to communicate with people where they're at. And I think with the IT industry, you know, there are enormously complex concepts that are now being communicated using very simple tools. And even if you just look at the Money Smart projector, you know, from the Australian government, that's a reasonably simple, kind of reasonably intuitive tool. I'd put it back that the onus is on us as actuaries to find simple and effective ways to communicate with people where they're at.
Yeah, I don't disagree with that. I think, though, even going to an app requires at least knowledge that you need to go look at an app. I think members of super funds at least do get sent information, and you hope that they might read it and then know where to go for answers. I mean, we've now got scaled advice where it's mostly, you know, now free. You can ring up and call a call centre and you can get some limited superannuation advice. So hopefully people are aware of that. But I think it's just getting more awareness out there and, yeah, we're trying, I suppose, hoping we can be responsible to do it. Yeah.
Tell me if you covered this when I was out of the room, but with the new changes that the government's proposed in the budget, one of the things that I've read about is where on relationship breakdowns, someone gets the house and the other person gets the super. So, you know, again, I'd probably think that most cases the female is looking after the children and get the house and therefore has no super to start and the husband's taken all the super. Depending upon what the history has been, she may then also have difficulty in terms of catching up because of those limits. Do you have any comments about that or any other comments?
Yeah, I mean, that's right. I mean, from the ones I've seen, that's more common that the female ends up with the lesser super. I don't think any of the budget proposals that I've seen have necessarily encouraged a more even split with super, because obviously that then causes issues. You probably then are forced to sell the home. And I think that has generally been in those marriage breakdowns where there are children involved, I think they try to avoid that if they can. But yeah, I mean, that's another option for consideration, that super is, you know, your partnership is considered as a partnership. So therefore when you split it, it should be a fair split on the super side. But I suppose they say, well, you could use your home as equity towards retirement income because you could downsize your home once your children have grown up and left home. But there's a, in the Senate inquiry report, there was a lot of talk about, women particularly take on generally extra things when the marriage breaks down in terms of children and raising the children, and there's often additional costs that were not really considered as part of the settlement. But I mean, as I said, a lot of them, just the lower incomes, don't even have homes. And actually finding adequate housing in retirement when they're living on an age pension is actually very, very difficult. And it was talking about that the availability of affordable and reasonable housing for people, and there are a higher number of women, single women, on the age pension than any other type of group. So it really has affected women the most.
Well, unless anyone wants to quickly put their hand up and ask any more questions, remember to complete your feedback forms. Just giving you all a chance. And then can you please join me in thanking Saffron for a very thought-provoking presentation.